We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. Today, as always, we start with the extraordinary Mike Bone telling a story called Seein' Bot. Then I interview Robin Talla with Project One Voice. And then we'll hear a short story by Stephen J. Payne, sometimes called Payne, called Red Loft. Stay tuned.
The other night I was watching television and I noticed that the ficus tree in front of our house had turned blue. I thought the police were outside and had their blue lights of shame on, and I looked out the window to see what was going on, and it wasn't the police. There was a small box about 2 feet high and about 18 inches long, maybe a foot and a half wide, on four wheels, moving down the sidewalk. It had two headlights and blue tail lights, and that was what was causing the tree to light up. It crossed the street next to our house and made a 90-degree turn to the right, crossed the street that went in front of our house, and went down the sidewalk. And I thought it was a kid with a robot, and I would see the person walking behind it with some controller, but I never saw this person. So I thought, that's strange. About 10 minutes later, I hear it coming back up the street, and I ran outside with my phone and videotaped it going down the street. There on the side of the box was a lettering that said scionbot.com snack delivery. I came back in the house and showed this to my wife, Lori, and said, place an order. And we went online and looked, and it was basically snack food. Potato chips, ice cream, Mexican Coke, Kashi. There were some household items like baking soda, deodorant. You could even get condoms there. Anyway, we made an order online and made a payment. And my wife said, I hope we didn't just waste $20. About 10 or 15 minutes later, she said, it's coming. And we went out on the front porch and could see this two headlights come over the hill and on the sidewalk, and you could see the blue light behind the box, and it made its way down the sidewalk and got to our walkway up to our house and made a 90-degree turn to the left and came up the walkway and stopped. My wife got a notification on her phone asking if she wanted to unlock the box, which she did. And I went down and picked up a paper bag from inside this box, closed the box up, and went back up on the porch. After about 20 seconds, the box made a 180-degree turn, went back down the walkway to the sidewalk, made a 90-degree turn to the west, and disappeared over the hill. This is remarkable to me. I don't know why, but it is. You know, here's a service delivering basically snacks right now. Who knows what they're going to be delivering in the future. If they ever start delivering beer, I'm totally screwed. And I couldn't see that there was any human interaction there at all. I'm sure someone somewhere had to put these items inside this bot, but I don't know who it was. So if you live on the West Side, prepare to have your mind blown.
This is Mystic Pete. It is October 2nd, 2020. I'm saying the date because so much is happening so quickly. By the time this gets aired, I just don't know what shape the world will be in. Today we found out our president has COVID-19, and we just don't know where that will be in a few days. So, audience, understand the day this is being recorded. And I have on the line Robin Talla, who is a spokesperson for media, politics, spirituality, health, festivals, activism, art. This man is involved in a lot of projects, and I've seen his work, and you just like this guy. There's something nice and smart about Talla, and involved in something called Project One Voice. Hey, Talla, talk to me. What did I miss?
Hey, Mystic Pete, it is so good to be here with you, and I'd say you did pretty good on that intro. You know, I'm a multifaceted being into a lot of different things, but you covered quite a lot of good ground there, so thanks for having me on today.
Tell me about Project One Voice.
Yeah, so, you know, I think like a lot of us, I've been just appalled watching my social media through the pandemic at the spread of misinformation and disinformation, and, you know, I get it. Like, it's hard to know what to believe these days. You know, it seems like every different news source might have some sort of agenda, and you know, we're getting these alternative narratives constantly introduced to us. But I am someone who has been, you know, following politics and is really interested in global events for a long time now, and so I have some practice at, you know, sorting through different sources and finding the actual data within the opinion. And I am, I walk in many different worlds, and one of the worlds I walk in is the world of health and wellness, festivals, parties, celebrations. I also walk in the world of activism, political, social, environmental activism as well. But what I noticed in my health and wellness and, you know, festival, Burning Man communities is that, you know, before the pandemic started, I would go to parties and events, and over again, people would tell me, oh, you know what, I don't even watch the news. It's too much for me either. You know, they're a highly sensitive person, which, you know, I'm as well, an empath. But, you know, for a lot of people, they just would tell me, you know, it's too much. I can't handle all of the news out there. So I really appreciate you following it because I can talk to you and find out what's going on. And so I would often be in this role of helping people understand, you know, what's going on in politics and what's going on in current events and all that. And then the pandemic hit, and because we couldn't go to a social event and all we were doing was sitting on our computers, a lot of these same kind of people all of a sudden became political experts just from what they read on their social media. And what I saw is it's easy to craft the narrative from whatever you are seeing. And really, none of us have the time and bandwidth to fully research everything that we see. So we're pretty much just choosing who to trust, you know, which narratives to trust or which thought leaders to trust. And in a time when so many people were so feeling so vulnerable, rightfully so, so scared, in some cases sick, or in some cases unemployed, just when the future seems so uncertain, it's natural for the human animal, for the sensitive heart to grasp for some kind of surety. And in a situation where we're really unsure and we actually don't know, we have a couple options. One, to be okay with not knowing, or two, to grab onto some kind of narrative and try and feel like we are sure about something. And so, you know, I think the latter option is what most people tend towards. And so I saw a lot of people in my community starting to buy into some of these narratives, some of them that are even questioning the nature of factual, data-driven reality. And so anyway, I started meeting up and talking with some people who are feeling the same way as I do, and I found out about this project, Project One Voice. And Project One Voice is, you know, a group of cultural creatives and media strategists and concerned citizens. And, you know, what we saw is that there was a lot of compelling media content coming out of one side of this story that was really capitalizing on people's fear. And we realized that, you know, those of us who are really standing for environmental justice and human rights and climate action and racial justice, we realized that there was a lot of compelling data on our side, but not a lot of emotionally driven, beautiful content that invites people into their hearts. And so Project One Voice is creating a place, a nonpartisan space, to just explore the data-driven reality of what's actually happening in the world that's backed up by, you know, the scientific method and by many years of academia and by, you know, people who have taken their lives to study these issues, but it's presenting in a way that is, that beckons us into our hearts, that allows us to actually connect with our emotions. And we feel that by doing that, we will be able to counterbalance some of the just barrage of disinformation and misinformation out there right now.
Well spoken. I have noticed in my community, in our community, in the festival and arts scene, before the current era, a tendency for people to be apolitical, non-political, or anti-political. And me as a very political person, feeling that this, the creating laws and good leadership is just a natural part of being a healer and a compassionate person on the planet. Like, I can give away sandwiches all day to homeless people and make a trivial improvement on a few people's lives, or we can pass one law that ends homelessness. But that happens at these top political levels, and unless you're engaged in those wheels, you're not going to solve homelessness. And there's all kinds of issues that this applies to. But now we're in a time of crisis, and it seems like non-involvement in a deathly situation, you know, tragedies happening in so many different directions, to be not involved almost seems selfish or self-involved. And I think people, as you say, they lurch towards easy answers, simple answers, identifiable villains, because we're actually in a very complicated situation with complicated solutions that take a long time to happen. But people want to, just to take a pill and get better and feel better. And that's what these extremist ideologies offer, I think. It's just that there's a savior, there's a simple answer. And so Project One Voice is trying to be a little bit of an antidote to that facile explanation and bring a little bit of head and sense and common sense to all the emotionality and our desperate need to find comfort and answers quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, I don't think it's a thing to look down upon that we humans want to feel good. Like, I want to feel good. I want to feel safe. And so it's natural that people would, it, you know, sometimes we find surety in things that may not make us feel good at first, but we feel good in having surety, even if it's around a subject that's scary. And this is an interesting part of the human psychology. And so I want that too, right? And so with Project One Voice, we realized that, like, there's so, like, we don't need the real life reality is enough of a conspiracy. Like, what is happening in our world is enough. Like, you know, the people, the asylum seekers from countries in Central America where the political landscape has actually been fueled by the actions and the history of our country's military intervention, destabilizing, you know, countries in Central America to the point of violence, and now the people coming to our beautiful nation that was built on immigrants to find safety and asylum, and then us now putting them in cages and then turning them back. I mean, that's enough of a real life conspiracy if you look at all of the things going on. And so what we're doing with this project is really doing our best to educate people about what's really happening in a way that they can also find some sense of surety, find some ground to stand on, and also to empower people, because the power is in our hands. If you look at the outsized influence of the United States government and policy is driven by our representatives who are elected by us, they are enacting our voices, and you look at how that policy of the United States affects the rest of the world. When we look into the world and see suffering, we really have this opportunity to have a hand in creating the solution by participating in our process. And you were saying, you were talking a little bit ago about how, you know, people in the arts and festival scene tended to be like apolitical. And I totally understand why. I mean, especially when your own life sometimes is overwhelming enough, or if, you know, we as artistic people sometimes are struggling just to get by financially and pay our own bills and do our own thing, it's hard to expose ourselves to a reality that could make our lives seem even more stressful by hearing about all of the horrible things that are happening around the world. And I have this great story. One time I was at a workshop at Symbiosis Festival in California, and the workshop was a presentation by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, and someone got up and asked Amy about this, and they said, you know, I feel so sensitive, I can't watch the news all the time, and I don't understand how you do it. I appreciate you for being on top of the global situation all the time, but, like, why do you do that to yourself? And Amy said, I want to tell you a story. She said, back when the Vietnam War was starting, a lot of people in the United States didn't know what was going on. And there was this photojournalist who went to the front lines of the Vietnam War. And they were taking photos, and one of these photos was of a very, very horrible thing. A child that had suffered a napalm burn and actually had napalm on them. And this photo was so compelling that it traveled around the world, and it woke such deep compassion and care in people's hearts that it ignited an entire movement that essentially ended up stopping the Vietnam War. So she said, and I agree with this, and this is the reason that I, as a highly sensitive person, make it, you know, a practice to pay attention to global events and politics and balance it out with self-care. And so she said, and I agree, that since we have such a beautiful life of privilege to have the freedom of speech, to live, for those of us who do, not assuming every listener has this, but for those of us who do have the privilege of a fairly comfortable life, of being able to put our time and energy into things like the arts, having safety where we don't have to worry about being bombed or violence from, you know, extremist groups or something like that, that if we have that privilege, it is our duty to people who are just like us, who might have been born in a different country, but they love music too, and they love playing with their friends. They're just like us, but they had the misfortune of being born in a different place in the world that was less stable and had more danger. And so it's our responsibility to look, to take some time to look at what's happening, to pay attention to what's happening, because when we do, and when we talk to each other, and when we snap that one photo that awakens empathy across an entire culture, we can change the reality to make a more peaceful world. And this is why I do what I do, because I care. I care so deeply for all people in the world. I want everyone, regardless of the color of their skin, which is scientifically being shown to be absolutely redundant and meaningless in our genetic code. We are genetically, of course, socially it carries a lot of meaning, and not downplaying that at all, but genetically we are one human family, and everyone deserves the same kind of peace. It's our birthright to be safe and loved and happy, and not just humans, but all creatures on Earth, you know, all living beings, all ecosystems. And that deep love, what Andrew Harvey calls sacred activism, that deep love drives me to turn on democracy now, to, you know, turn on the sources that of media that I trust, The Intercept or whatever, to listen and expose myself sometimes, even though it may be hard, but that I do that because it is part of the process of engaging and creating a better world. And so I think that that is sort of the missing link for a lot of people who are, like, you know, in the arts community, because they want that same thing. They want to create a better world, and they love peace and environmental sustainability, and they want... And so now they've been thrown into an atmosphere where, you know, we don't have much to cling to, so we're looking online, and we may not have had that training to know what is good and what's not, how to actually cite, you know, information, citations, figure out, like, what is just hyperbole that is, like, crescendoed by millions or hundreds of YouTube videos that are all saying the same thing and echoing each other, how to sort, you know, actual data-driven information from just echo chamber stuff that people are wanting to believe to feel safe. And so the number one piece of advice I have for anyone out there listening who is struggling with some of these things of knowing what to believe and what not to believe is to first come back into your heart and to make decisions from a place of love. And if something if a piece of media you're consuming is using fear in order to make you believe something, it's very likely that there's an ulterior motive there. But when there is a hard thing you're hearing about that's driven by just data that's not telling you what to believe, that's more likely just like tapping into what's actually going on in the world. And so anyway, with Project One Voice, we're just really trying to be a space where people can come and they can trust the information that they find there, and if they want to research it, we list all of our citations to all the places where we are gathering our data from. And so, yeah, you know, I just really think that as much as we may want to, when we see someone post something we don't agree with on social media, as much as we may want to, like, stand up and rage against it and you know, call them a name for thinking such a silly thing, whether it's on one side or the other, you know, I really feel like the work is to come back into that space of care and realize we're all trying to create a better world, and then see how we can improve our information hygiene to make sure that whatever narrative that we're promoting is based in real world data and is emotionally connective.
Very well put. Well, I have a couple of questions here. They kind of lead into very deep topics along what you've already raised. But first, I want to just mention that when I was a kid, I think about 4 years old, I saw that photo when it was first published. So I'm a little bit older. We're talking about the early 60s. And I was a young child, and I had heard about Vietnam War. I didn't quite know what it was, you know, and my parents were activists. I saw this photo laying out on the dining room table, and I saw it and I started crying as a little kid, and I got it. I at that moment, I got what the Vietnam War was about. So I want to validate the power of that image and the power of arts. Also, now bring up this issue of fascism, which has been talked about a lot in mainstream media. And are we descending into fascism? Heavy topic, but it's a real concern for a lot of people. And I think fascism happens when people want simple answers. Times of change, complicated times, the old systems are getting shaken. Maybe there has new things have to come along, but sometimes people don't want to change and shed their skin. And somebody comes along and says, oh, it's simple. The reason why you're not you don't get enough money and you're not happy and life is difficult for you, it's easy. It's the Jews. It's the blacks. It's the Chinese. It's the Muslims. It's those people. It's the gays. It's the Hollywood people. Oh, it's the leftists. It's real simple. That's the enemy. And it makes it very easy for a lot of people to consume, to have such a simple villain to identify as the cause of their pain. I think that fascism is problematic. I mean, aside from just many horrors, civil rights violations and the end of democracy and justice and so forth, like all that obvious stuff, it's also a terribly corrupt system. Fascist states, by the end of it, they're destroyed. Everything becomes corrupted from the top to bottom because everybody's paying off everybody. It's to get access to the king, to the dictator. So utterly destroys the country. So people trade in a complicated, difficult solutions for simple ones that lead to annihilation of who they are. And there's just ruins afterwards. So it's a good reason for not adopting fascism and simple answers. And you have talked about, like, yeah, the simple solution versus the sensible solution. And looking deeper and looking at what is fear-based and what is heart-based, so we don't grasp onto these easy answers. So I'm getting to my point here. I got in one of these discussions on Facebook, and they were ranting. Oh, by the way, the first wave of identifying the villain is also, it's the fact-checkers. It's the journalists. It's the scientists. They're the problems. And you can see that happening. That always happens when fascism comes. They start attacking the journalists. So I got into one of these discussions with the conspirituality wellness crowd who think the pandemic is all a fiction. And if you wear a mask, it activates your own virus. And that's what gets you sick. And just kind of all this ridiculous stuff. I say, what you're believing is fear-based belief systems. And I say, the truth is, there's really a pandemic. And then they say, well, you're enrolling, you're backing up, you're believing in a fear-based belief system. You're talking about a pandemic. You're just scared, Peter. So this is this long explanation. This is where I'm getting to. How do we distinguish fear-based analysis from heart-based analysis? Because there are a lot of genuine things to be scared of right now that we should be careful about.
I think one of the great challenges we have right now that is in our power individually to resist fascism, which I think that's one thing that a lot of us can find common ground on. Whether it's someone who is feeling like they can't trust the mainstream media or someone that feels that most mainstream media sources, while being having a problematic power dynamic in terms of ownership of the corporation that controls that mainstream media, trust a lot of the really, really well-spoken independent journalists that still are featured there and are not censored. There's that. So whether you're on one side or the other, it's totally understandable why people would not trust the mainstream media, because if you look at it simplistically, it just looks like Rupert Murdoch owns everything, and he'll just control and turn the dial and say whatever he wants to say, and that's what everyone thinks, right? So it's easy to see how someone would feel that way. I mean, I'm an activist. I don't take everything at face value. You know, I look at the power dynamics behind all these things. I think it's problematic, the corporate ownership of our media, for sure. But then I also look at, you know, a source like, say, the New York Times, and I see them featuring writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's an incredible independent thinker, and he's suggesting very, very forward-thinking ideas that are obviously not being censored. If you would take his writing and then you would look at what, you know, I'm not sure if Murdoch even owns the Times, but like whoever owns the Times, the corporation, like what their best interest would be, that's actually a conflict. And what that shows is that a lot of these mainstream media sources are actually not 100% compromised. It's not one way or the other. There's definitely a problematic dynamic here with, you know, our capitalist system and how that relates to the media. But, you know, whether you're someone who doesn't trust the media, or you're someone who does, or maybe you're someone in the middle, or you recognize the complex dynamic of things, one of the hardest things to know right now, like I was talking about, is what to believe. And what you were speaking of with this Facebook conversation that you were having is frankly maddening. It's maddening on both sides, because the human brain is still functioning in the genetics and the programming that we've had for hundreds of thousands of years. And social media is so brand new. The internet is a massive change in the way that humans relate to each other, and it's so brand new that there's not even any chance. I mean, the scale of biological evolution is so slow, and the way that our brains develop is so slow, and all of a sudden we have this collective intelligence like connection that is totally different than anything that humans have ever experienced. So here we are in this world that is so complicated, and we have to figure out how to use the internet and what to believe. That's an impossible scenario. So what ends up happening is these rhetorical circular conversations where you can just get into, I know you are, but what am I? I know you are, but what am I? Both sides could say that. And both sides could be right to an extent, and both sides could be wrong to an extent, right? So it's like, okay, so your question is, how do we navigate in that space? And this is where it comes back to data for me, because you can never say, I only believe things that I see with my own eyes, right? Because then there's no common shared, like if everyone in the world said that, then we would have, there would be chaos, because no law would work, no system of organized government would work, and sure, in a utopia, all of us love and care about each other, but what we've seen through our history is that greed is a very powerful force, and many, many humans succumb to greed, especially being raised in a Western capitalist system that leads us to function from everyone for themselves, me first, right? So we can't, we obviously, I think everyone agree that we can't just like have no laws and no collective and everyone just goes with what they think, right? So if we can't do that, if we can agree on both sides that we can't do that, then we have to agree that there's some way that you can trust something that you don't have personal experience with. Okay, so how do we do that? And this is the fundamental place that I get back to when I think about this. The difference between opinion and data, what we can rely on, even though it might seem boring, even though you might not want to get into all the facts, if you had a broken leg, you would go to a doctor that knows how to fix a broken leg. That's because of science. That's because of the scientific process. And I know that you wouldn't just go to someone and they'd say, oh, for a broken leg, you want to just pour vinegar on it, and that's just an opinion, and then you have science. And I know that in this world, science is starting to get used as like a way to prove something, like, oh, I'm right because of science. But if you talk to true scientists, they are always trying to disprove themselves. True science is always trying to find the root of truth based on evidence and based on fact at the heart of science. And the best thing as a scientist you can do is dig and dig and dig and dig and try and disprove yourself. This is the opposite of what drives fascism and autocracy, which is that you try at all costs. I mean, we can all see when we watch what's currently going on. You try at all costs not to be proven wrong, even if you have to lie through your teeth over and over and over so many times that people start to believe it. So when I'm sorting through information online, because I don't just trust everything the government says, I don't just trust everything the media says, I came to all of this from being an activist as a teenager, from being a nonconformist, which I still am at my core. But I also have learned that there has to be some common set of values that a society functions on, or else it descends into utter chaos. And when it goes into chaos, that's when autocrats, fascists, dictators can perpetrate atrocities that are covered by people's overwhelm in the chaos. So in these times of chaos, especially in this moment that we're facing right now before this very consequential election, it's important that we don't just respond to our base level emotions, but we actually perform the information and opinion hygiene to look at what is behind the statements and who is behind the statements and what is the data that's there to back it up and what is the evidence from people who are actually humbly trying to create a solid ground of evidence for people to stand on, not the other way around, not trying to create a reaction and make a story to support that reaction. And so I know I've been on this monologue for a second, but I'll wrap up just to say that I think when we don't do these things, you're right, it provides an opportunity when people are feeling desperate and in chaos and they're not willing to do the work to actually look at the complexity behind it, and they do succumb to the numbing, warm place that is surety inside us, even if it's surety about a scary thing, being sure about something that it just seems right, it just feels right. That's what a lot of more you know, New Age folks I know. And by the way, I was born on the Sufi path. I've been a part of mystical tradition from the time I was in my mother's womb, and I'm a practicing mystic, you know, so I'm not just some, like, science freak. But I see that when we adhere too strongly to magical thinking and don't balance it out with also data and logic, then we can tend to just want to trust our hearts. And sometimes our hearts are operating in fear, and that fear can be manipulated in order for us to believe something that is actually perpetrating our own danger, our own destruction. And Orwellian speech, oftentimes these fascist regimes or any kind of person who's moving towards dictatorship or autocrat speaks in an Orwellian way. They say that they're doing the exact opposite thing that they're actually doing. And when we look at the science and the data of our current situation, we see that's what's happening. So I think my call to action for everyone listening to this is just to be, first of all, come back to your heart. Look for whether your storyline you're believing is driven by fear or driven by love, and then also take the time to actually examine the data and figure out what this information is based on. For if we don't do this in mass right now, then we do endanger our entire democracy. And throughout our past, we can see countries that have gone from a functioning democracy into a dictatorship. It's happened. It happened in Egypt. In, you know, the 60s, 50s and 60s, Egypt was a functioning democracy where women had total rights, and it has descended now into a total dictatorship that's very sexist. And so we need to nurture and love and take care of and steward the beautiful, yet, you know, flawed democracy that we do have in order to work towards a more perfect world and a more perfect society, rather than seeking comfort and letting it descend into chaos.
Yeah, rather than going, oh, everything sucks, so let's just like blow the whole thing up. No, everything could be a lot worse if we let the whole fabric of goodness get ripped apart. But I will say also that this initiation by current crisis has caused conversations on radio like this that weren't happening a year or 5 years ago. So something's going deep, and we're going very deep on mass media right now, you and I, Tala. I also wanted to validate your point about science and journalism being self-adjusting and evolving. Like cults and agenda-driven philosophy, they just want to shove their opinions down your throat. But science prides itself on questioning itself. So does journalism. And there's a trend towards admitting mistakes, and they know mistakes happen. So it does advance, and as opposed to these hardcore philosophies that just want to get you to do what they want you to do. The last thing I'd like to talk about is I'll see lists on wellness sites or just in general media about how to take care of yourself. And you'll see things like cook for yourself, sleep, walk, go in nature, exercise. But often there's stop watching media. And now this is just what we're talking about. And I get upset because watching media to me is vital right now. It's how I learn and how I understand what's happening, how I get facts and how I stay in touch. But it brings us to the discussion of how we can distinguish between media that may be corporate influenced, but is generally heading in the right direction, generally struggling to be honest, honorable truth tellers, versus government-sponsored media that is really agenda-driven and just lying most of the time. And you probably can guess I have my opinions about which one is which. But how do we distinguish? How do we figure that out? What media to watch?
Well, I think it comes back to actually engaging in the process of distinguishing for yourself. Like, you know, use some of the tools that you've learned in this episode or on the show or in other places to figure out, like, is this source of media offering me where it's getting its data? Is it open to being proven in other ways? If anyone ever tells you just believe this source and any other source that tells you differently as part of the problem, that should be a major red flag, because our world doesn't work like that. There's so many people in the world, and if one opinion or set of data that you're looking at is true, it will be independently verified, not on another YouTube video, but, and I'm nothing against YouTube, I love YouTube, there's a lot of good information there, but just because it's there doesn't mean it's real, right? Anyone can say anything in that space. So it comes back to data and science, and I think we've covered that. But, you know, I think that we have to challenge ourselves to not polarize, because anytime you're like, oh, all mainstream media is, you know, untrue, that's such a huge statement. First of all, mainstream media isn't a technical term. You know, there's all kinds of media all over the world that is distributed on a national or global level. And now that we have widespread access to the internet in almost every country, what's more mainstream than putting your opinion out somewhere where the entire world can see? I mean, mainstream is big, grassroots is small. If you're limited, your audience, that's the opposite of mainstream. So everything is like, mainstream media actually doesn't mean anything right now. But I think what people are looking at is they're nervous that certain people in positions of power with financial stake or ownership of a certain conglomerate corporation that may have bought a media company, they're nervous that that person's individual morals and values, or morals and values that benefit their corporation, will control the narrative that's coming out of that media source. Now, I share that concern. However, when I look at most reputable media sources, I don't see that happening very much. And here's the reason. It would be a wish for its own destruction, because the whole premise of, you know, the New York Times, or I'm using that as the example, but the whole premise of a mainstream media outlet is, the point of it is a place where people can come to get unbiased information. Now, of course, it's never going to be 100% true, right? There's always going to be certain things that may not make it into that. But in general, if that media source descends into so much special interest-based broadcasting of very hand-picked values, they will lose all of their readers, all of their listeners, all their membership, because people are smarter than that. So they have to, it's a self-policing system. They have to maintain some semblance of independence and feature journalists who even say the opposite things that they might stand for. You know, sometimes when you're listening to like an NPR podcast, they might say, they might have a story that is critical of Facebook. I've been hearing a lot of stuff about how Facebook is handling the elections and misinformation, and NPR has been running tons of stories about how Facebook is really fumbling this, and then they'll say, hey, just to be clear, Facebook is one of our sponsors. Well, there's an example of the media working. Facebook isn't controlling NPR. They're their sponsor, but they're not saying, oh, since we're your sponsor, you can't say anything bad about us. They're still running stories. That's an example of independent journalism working, which is an essential part of any democracy. So I also wanted to return to a point that you made about these wellness. And by the way, I actually, for my job, I work in holistic health and wellness, specifically around nutrition. I believe very strongly that the basis of our wellness is a plant-based, organic, non-GMO diet. That is so important. Now, with COVID, I think that we are dealing with a particular virus that is very mysterious, and there's a lot we don't know about yet. So I'm going to base my own basic immunity on health and wellness around holistic nutrition, of course, eating locally, finding certain products, and recommending certain products that are incredibly high integrity and high nutritional value, like superfoods and things like that. But I'm also, it's a both and scenario, but I'm also going to take every precaution against COVID. And if I do have a broken limb or a severe infection, I'm also going to utilize Western allopathic medicine in order to, you know, keep living, whereas in the past, before allopathic medicine, no matter how many superfoods I was eating as a human, you know, in, you know, several hundred or thousand years ago, I would have just died from that condition. So there's a place for both. It's a both and scenario. It's, this scenario is beckoning us into being complex thinking individuals, which we can all rise into if we stop just letting our base level fear and emotional reactionariness control us. So I say that to establish a foundation of trust with your listeners, because what I'm going into saying about media and about wellness, I don't want anybody listening to this to think, oh, well, he's just some guy who doesn't care about holistic wellness. No, I am. That's actually the foundation of my entire business and my philosophy. So, you know, if somebody is making this list and they're telling you, you know, drink lots of water or, you know, eat good nutrition, yes, of course. But, you know, if they were to say, don't watch the media, that's a polarizing statement. That's an absolutist statement. That's saying absolutely don't do this one thing. Now, any absolutist statement, as we all know, is not, there's no truth in absolutism. It's always a balance. It's our life is a continuum, is a spectrum, right? And so I think what that point, you know, the internet likes to reduce us down to the smallest sound bite, and so don't watch the media is an easy thing to say. But what that really means is, be careful of your emotional and mental health when consuming media, because it can be easy to get sucked in and get doom and gloom. And for some people, that can be very challenging to their mental well-being. But at the same time, like we talked about earlier, it is vital that those of us living in a country that is arguably the most powerful, if not one of the most powerful countries of the world to influence the state of the world via our political system, our leadership, and the decisions that our collectively, our country makes through its voting and its representation and its policies, it is vital that we stay aware, I believe, as a wellness community, as an artistic community, as an empathic community, we need empaths at the table. If no empaths and no wellness people are at the table making decisions, then they're going to be made, all the decisions of the world are going to be made by people who do not value those things, and then our world will get even worse. So what I think, you know, about that advice for your mental wellness, don't watch media, I think that that's an overly simplified way of saying take care of yourself, which is very true. Be careful about your mental state and make sure that you're also feeling lots of good things and not just exposing yourself to lots of challenging dynamics. But I do feel that as the very privileged people living in this country, there's a huge spectrum of privilege. Some people are way more privileged than others, but if you take our country in relation to many other countries in the world, then our country exists on an extreme side of privilege comparatively. And so if we're going to benefit from that system, which we all do, because you can't stay still on the moving train, then it's our responsibility to examine and be aware of what is happening. And no matter what, you are living in a country where you are, if you're in the United States listening to this, you are living in a country where your taxes, anytime you use money, anytime you pump gas, you are part of the system. And you can't say, I don't do politics. Too bad. If you say you don't do politics, you're just closing your eyes to something that you are already involved with. You are involved with the system. Politics is only a set of leadership that governs and makes decisions about our everyday reality. And so I think it's our responsibility. And I think when people really understand that they are a part of that system, I think it's a very empowering thing to pay attention to the media and to understand politics so that you can play an empowered role in shaping the state of our world.
Tala, well spoken. Well, I'm going to get in the last word here and answer my own question that came to me as you were talking and tell you how I deal with media and figuring out what's right. I expose myself to a lot of it. I watch CNN, MSNBC, I watch Fox, I subscribe to paper. Every morning I read the paper, PBS, NPR, I listen to a lot of radio. I don't do it to the point of depression or so it breaks me. I don't know, I kind of find it fascinating. I don't mean to lose a lot of my listeners, but I find it more interesting than sports. Imagine that. So it's to me, it's very engaging. It's very entertaining. And I put strict limits on it. And I know how much I can watch before I get overwhelmed. And then I turn it off. But I expose myself to a lot of different sources. And I think that's also a kind of a smart approach. In any case, Tala, thank you very much for spending this time with me on October 2nd, 2020. A lot of change, a lot happening. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mystic P. It's so good to be here with you. And I just want to encourage everyone listening to be involved and open your hearts and do whatever you can to be part of shaping our world to make it more beautiful and equitable and just for all living beings on this planet. Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
Beautifully put. Yay, Tala! Bye-bye.
Bye.
The story of the Red Loft. I was eating breakfast with my new girlfriend, Mariko, at Just Eat in Silver Lake, and I mentioned that I'd be moving soon, and I quite fancied living in a big loft downtown. She said she liked that idea and would want to join me. We'd only been together 2 weeks, but hey, why not? So I looked around for a few days, and I got a call from my friend Kevin Raleigh, who was managing a building on 7th Street. As he opened the door, I realized I already knew the place, as my friend Sarah, who I knew from the UK, had lived there, and I had visited her a few years earlier and loved the space. I called Mariko to tell her about it and suggested she come and see it, but she was so excited, she told me to just get it. So I called Kevin back, and that was that. We moved in a few days later. But the paint scheme was horrible. Dull browns and a putrid yellow. So we set about painting and fixing things up. The walls were 15 foot high and took a lot of paint. I did the big stuff, and Mariko took care of the details. We were both ridiculously happy. It was a massive new beginning for both of us. Within a couple of weeks, we were planning our first event, a film screening. But what to call the place? Half the walls were red and the other half were brick. The Red Brick Cinema was born. Alas, Mariko and I did not last. She met someone at a party and moved in with him the very next day. Oddly enough, they're still together, so I guess she made the right call. Giving up that loft was not an option, though, and I took the place on alone. The Red Brick Cinema became the Red Loft. It was 2002, and I'd been to Burning Man. The party was just getting started. So much silliness, one of my favourites being the night the LAPD showed up when the Mutator were performing on the roof. Not to complain, but to check out the band. Or the time some drunk idiot fell through the neighbour's skylight. Or the time needed to borrow my bed. Or when DJ stormed off because I told him his transitions were too loud. Both Bedlam and Space Island were close by, and the regeneration of the Arts District got underway. After four fun-packed years, the building got sold, and we were all out. I couldn't face renting an apartment, so I lived in my RV for about 9 months before finding a nice space at the brewery, but it wasn't really conducive to events. I bounced around LA for another couple of years before finding Syrup, but then I found an even better place on Seton, 4,400 square foot on the top floor. The Red Loft 3.0 was born. I did comedy shows, video and film shoots, live music, art shows, and much more. One of the best nights was the LA DCOM after party, when over 500 people showed up because the other venue got shut down. I made $5,500 that night, and everyone had a blast. Even Elon Musk showed up at one of those events. But again, after 3 years, the building got sold, and when the new owners found out I was only paying 33 cents a square foot, it was time to move on. I booked one last film shoot literally as I was moving out, pushing carts through their set between takes. The final Red Loft was on 5th and Town, another 4 years of chaos and fun. The rent was $2,200 a month, and Mr. Khan, the building owner, who had a strange shop on the ground floor, and I never fell out. It's amazing what you can get away with when you always pay the full rent on the first of the month. I really liked that place on Town, and it was certainly one of the most creative times in my life so far. How did I get away with it? Easy. I always paid the rent on time, and I knew how to politely tell the LAPD that they could not enter without a warrant, and yes, they tried several times. I even had to call out the desk sergeant and have him explain that they could not enter one time. But really, it was the people who attended that made these places work. I never had to break up a single fight, not one, ever, in 10 years. People felt safe, and somehow with the help of countless bartenders, door people, security people, DJs, actors, musicians, we made it work. Although I now live on a boat in Europe and there will never be another Red Loft, I cherish all the amazing adventures I had there and the wonderfully creative friends I made. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. Today we started with a story by Mike Bone called Seein' Bot. Then I interviewed Robin Tala with Project One Voice and wrapped it up with a short story by Stephen J. Payne, sometimes known as Payne, Red Loft. Thanks for tuning in. Mystic Pete out.